April is National Poetry Month, and Public Radio 90 observes the occasion by presenting readings by poets from the Northern Michigan University and surrounding communities. Dan Mancia, PhD, lives in Grand Rapids, Michigan with his partner Liz and their pup Sophie. He is professor of general education at Aquinas College. His fiction has appeared in such publications as Barrel House, the Chicago Tribune, Monkey Bicycle, the Saturday Evening Post, and River Styx, among other journals. He's the author of the novella The Death Mask of El Gaucho from Passages North and Little Presque Books, and All the Proud Fathers, a story collection from Dock Street Press. You can read more about him and his work at danmancia.com.
This is a reading from my novel and stories, All the Proud Fathers, which will be out in May from Dock Street Press. The first piece I'll be reading is called MIA. Columns of dandelions advance on the grass as Rommel traverses the dunes of my sandbox. I deploy sniper guys behind Flacco's lines, aim them at his generals, Patton and Montgomery. I suggest the names. Flacco's the good guys. They always win, he insists. I like to be the Germans because their helmets look cool and Panzer sounds tougher than tank. I make Flacco count his men. They're green, easy MIAs in the tall grass. Dad might chop them when he mows the lawn. The Germans are tan or gray or yellow like my dandelion Africa Corps. Our dads wear blue uniforms. But yours doesn't even carry a gun, Flacco says. His dad is a mall cop in Wisconsin, and mine delivers the mail here in Blackhawk. My dad was in the army, I say. He had all kinds of guns, even drove a tank. My dad shot somebody, undercover, on a stakeout. Shot a guy dead, Flacco says. I don't believe him, of course. Not because mall security guards don't go on stakeouts or carry guns. I don't believe Flacco because I can't picture his old man. Never met him. Would he say freeze punk or stop in the name of the law to the bad guys? Flacco wouldn't know either. My Panzer rolls over a landmine. Flacco makes an explosion noise and swipes the tank onto its side. Spit bubbles in the corner of his mouth. No man's land, he says. In the army, my dad always shot guys. I lie. Even gutted some with his bayonet. Dad fed shells to the cannon of his tank during the war. He once showed me a picture from that time. In it, he's beardless, his body flat, except for arms that bulge when he curls shells three at a time. He leans against his Panzer, camouflaged by pyramids of empty beer cans, and considers the circumference of his biceps. A handful of pebbles, my artillery shells, rain down on Flacco's lines. No fair, cheater. Flacco's mad I'm aiming at his army's headquarters. He resurrects his generals, hides them under a bunker of twigs. These guys didn't die. You can't kill them from over there. Sure you can, I say. I call truce, run to the front yard, to the sound of the lawnmower. I want Dad to explain that cannons do have that kind of range. I know Flacco has trouble judging distances. He speaks of Wisconsin as if it's more remote than the Sahara. Okay. This story is called Baptism, and it was originally published by Passages North here at Northern Michigan University. The new parents return from St. Alphonsus and discover their front porch blanketed under a foot of soil. From sidewalk to sill, the dirt is groomed more carefully than a Zen garden. When she considers the tiny furrows, so fine they could have been raked by fork, the mother sees rows of corn stalks, lines of lonely boys. She grew up on Foothill Road in a trailer park abutting the city's last farm. As a child, she wandered through the farm's cornfields, stomping the soft earth, searching for a patch of quicksand or sinkhole, some portal to another world. When that proved fruitless, she'd snap off an ear of corn, hold it to her mouth, and rehearse answers for the talk shows she'd frequent after she escaped the trailer park and made great discoveries as an archaeologist. Just think of it, Barbara, she'd marvel into an ear of corn. all that treasure beneath our feet. When she was older, she'd lead boys into those fields where they'd commit mortal sin, always the same sin, sin to which she would never confess. She sought no priest's absolution, but dug miniature graves in the furrows, no bigger than a shoebox, one for each lover. She marked their graves with corn cobs instead of names, one cob for the selfish, handsy boys who finished too soon, two cobs for the gentle, sweet boys she mothered along so they could satisfy her. There had only been a pair worthy of three cobs, boys who knew what to do with her from the start. The first one had enlisted in the Navy and shipped off after their only rendezvous. She brought the second one out to the cornfield for nearly 2 years. They conceived there in winter, married before she started to show. The father rocks their son on his shoulder. The infant's baptism gown glows white, gleams like a fresh snow against the soil. The father resists the urge to plunge into the dirt and demonstrate the art of snow angels for the infant. As a boy, he loved nothing more than diving into new-fallen snow, to be the first to spread wings and leave his impression. He squats down, smells the earth on their porch, smells the anointing oil on their son, reaches a hand over the neatly raked soil, but stops before disturbing the tableau. Remembers the summer he was 10 and a gypsy family moved next door. There'd been a gypsy boy he'd played with, Mike Dave, who carried a pouch of dirt with him wherever he went. "Graveyard bone dust," Mike Dave insisted. "Present from my busha." His grandmother told fortunes and devised hexes and gifted Mike Dave with dirt enchanted to protect him from enemies. The father convinces himself the dirt on their porch is protection for his family and not a prank or curse. He can't remember crossing Mike Dave during that brief time. They were neighbors. Only remembers thinking it odd the boy had two first names. His son only has one first name, but he has a middle name. It's a family name, passed down 5 generations. He'll acquire a third name if he chooses to confirm his faith when he comes of age. While the father is a young man of sound mind and body, he cannot immediately recall his own confirmation name. When it does come to him, the father regrets what little thought he'd put into choosing it. If his son ever asks his confirmation name, the father will choose more carefully. The father notes the soil's color. He will repaint the nursery port soil black, protection for the child when the father's not around. He'd paint the entire house that color, but knows his wife wants to move. They bought the house a year ago, an old home in an old neighborhood. It suited the father more than the mother. He planned projects, refinished floors, fenced in their meager yard for the day they'd bring home a dog. The trailer park where the mother grew up was old, not antique or historic, just old, charmless, without nostalgia. Last time she'd been out to Foothill Road, she saw the dump trucks and earth movers lined up straight as cornrows. Soon those machines would break ground, bulldoze crops, dig foundations for new homes. She hopes they'll be able to afford one of those new homes, dreams they'll find contentment there. She runs a hand through her husband's hair, strokes her son's cheek. Both parents now hold the infant just as they had over the baptismal font. She kisses her husband, and then he lets go, plunges backward into the dirt. The infant's eyes grow wide when his father sprouts wings.
These National Poetry Month readings are a Public Radio 90 production, recorded and produced in the facilities of WNMU-FM at Northern Michigan University. I'm producer and host Kurt Hosworth. Thanks for listening.